All right, here we go. Quiet!
Quiet! Quiet!
Roll them!
Hello and welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of today and yesterday, and put it all into some sort of context. Seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online Editor-in-Chief, Rich Dries.
And seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online Contributing Editor, Natasha Bogutsky. How's it going, Natasha? We're not going to go back to that.
I was just watching a very cute dog video.
I know. It was so sweet, little puppy.
I know.
You do this to me right before we start to record.
Oh, well, dogs help take my mind off spiders.
Okay.
But there is definitely one spider that I don't want my mind being taken off of this week.
Wow, that's a heck of a transition. Oh, who could that have been?
Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Those little spider-cats sweeps away.
Yeah, Kevin Feige's had one hell of a week.
I heard.
So let's start backwards on this, seeing as how that's how we're going here. And we'll start with the news that just broke on Friday, a couple of days ago now, that Sony and Marvel have come to an agreement and there will be at least one more Spider-Man film jointly produced by them. Yeah. And Spider-Man will appear in at least one other Marvel Cinematic Universe film.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah. From a storytelling standpoint, I was having a little trouble seeing how...
they'd fix that?
How they would finish all those storylines ending, dangling out of the end of Spider-Man Far From Home, and how they would be able to kind of do that without any of the Marvel Cinematic Universe connections.
Yeah, it doesn't make much sense to me, but hell, I'm happy that this is occurring.
True. I mean, it started off the deal that Sony and Marvel came to share the Spider-Man character and have some MCU characters kind of appear in Spider-Man movies and vice versa and cross-pollinate like that was coming to an end with Spider-Man Far From Home. Mm-hmm. The deal was for Sony to bankroll two Spider-Man films, have Marvel basically have all the creative decisions with those films, and Marvel would only get like 5% of the gross box office plus all the merchandising money, which is a lot. And because Sony was bankrolling the whole thing, they would keep all the rest of the box office. And, you know, there was a nice bit of sharing. It kind of beefed up the Marvel Cinematic Universe with an inclusion of a favorite character that just Marvel hasn't been able to claw back from Sony yet entirely because, you know, back in the early 90s, Marvel was just about broke. So they were selling film rights to characters off left, right, and center at fire sale prices. And Sony eventually wound up with the Spider-Man rights and have held on to it ever since, really, since 2001 with the, 2002.
With Sam Raimi's.
With the first Sam Raimi film. Yeah. And, you know, they've been doing okay. The Sam Raimi trilogy did pretty good. The two Andrew Garfield films, not as well. But they really kind of struck gold by partnering up with Marvel. Mm-hmm. And the folks over at Disney were like, well, now that the deal's over, could we renegotiate some of these terms? And Disney slash Marvel was like, hey, we'll pay 50% of the budget, but we get 50% of the box office in return. And Sony was kind of like, nah, I don't know about that. They crunched the numbers and thought better of it. And they had reached an impasse. And then very publicly, it became known that they had split on this and fandom freaked. And then just literally this past Thursday night, they came to an agreement to sign a deal. You know, Disney's now going to pay 25% of the overall budget and marketing and everything, and get 25% of the gross back. Sony, you know, pays for 75% of the film and gets 75% of the box office. So everybody's happy. Everybody's still making money. Fans are happy. So it was a happy ending.
Thank God.
Yeah. And that's not the only thing Kevin Feige, head of Marvel Studios, was in the news for last week.
Yeah. there's something about Star Wars movie.
Yeah. Yeah. He apparently a couple of weeks ago had a meeting with Kathleen Kennedy and head of Lucasfilm, and Alan Horn, head of the overall Disney film side, and basically pitched a Star Wars film to him. I mean, Feige's known for being a Star Wars fan. And so, obviously, at some point, I'm sure he was itching to play in that sandbox, despite all his love for what he's doing over, you know, with Marvel. So, whether it actually happens or not, we'll see. But it's interesting to see that kind of synergy between the two corporate cousins there at Disney, between Marvel and Lucasfilm. So, that should be fun.
Says you.
You don't think Kevin Feige could turn an arousing, adventurous Star Wars film?
I do, but that's not the problem I have with it.
Okay, what's the problem you have with it then?
One of the things, I'm probably not going to go see it because it's just not appealing to me, but I have a great respect right now for the Russos going off and doing 21 Blocks.
21 Bridges?
Or yeah, 21 Bridges, mm-hmm. Pardon me. Yeah, because it is showing more of a widened range.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I feel like Fahey's just jumping from one franchise to another.
Okay.
It's not showing range. And that's what I really want to see.
If he can create some kind of new IP, new film, an original idea. And,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem, is that there's just so little and original ideas out there now at the box office. And we covered this a few weeks back.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
That there has only been one movie in the top 10 films of this year that's an original idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, but the whole idea of original films being wiped out scares the ever freaking bejesus out of me.
Well,
as a filmmaker, it scares me.
Oh, as a filmmaker too, it bothers me that, you know, you don't see at the box office high concept films. And I was kind of thinking about this actually the last couple of weeks.
And I think that Kevin Feige's resources, he can turn out some really great movies.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We know that you can turn out a damn good Marvel movie in any genre. In any goddamn genre.
So you just want to see him do like a political thriller that's not related to the Marvel universe.
I want to see him try something brand new that is not another property.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think if he were ever to leave Marvel, we definitely would see him apply that magic touch he has to, you know, other things. But as long as he's like the head of Marvel Studios, he's just going to be making he's kind of tied down to making Marvel movies. Marvel Studios
then
is not going to make
Star
original
Wars
stuff. Marvel Studios is there for exploitation of the IPs of Marvel Comics.
I know that, but you can also attach yourself. If he can attach himself to a Star Wars project, then he can attach himself to something that's completely original. Why are you not trying to take a risk when you have that kind of influence?
That's true. He could go over and another corporate sibling now. 20th Century Fox. He could go over to Fox and say, I want to do this.
I want to bankroll an idea maybe out of Searchlight.
Yeah. A nice little character-based drama. You know, and throw that through Searchlight. I have this great idea for a kids movie. Throw it through, you know, Walt Disney Studios.
Why
I'm
is
sure
that
he could
so
do a lot. I don't know. I don't know. He needs to sleep at some point. I know I get like that too. I'm like, crap, I gotta sleep.
I will. Yeah, you need the sleep. Mm-hmm. But, you know, tacking on a Star Wars freaking movie, I mean, that's the second biggest franchise out there right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he's attaching himself to something
after
after
him running the first biggest franchise out.
Yeah. And I feel like an original idea might be a little less weight than taking on another big fucking franchise.
I agree with you. I definitely agree with you.
So you want to say you need to sleep sometime? He'll get more sleep doing that than he will doing this.
Now, the Star Wars thing could never come about. They might not be able to find a screenwriter who gives them something that they like. I don't know. It was just a meeting, but it was kind of big. And, you know, immediately some sectors of fandom kind of blew it out of proportion to say, oh, Kathleen Kennedy's on her way out of Lucasfilm and he's going to take over Lucasfilm now and Star Wars will be blah, blah, or
okay,
whatever.
That's a bit much.
Well, yeah. I mean, It's like, wow, they wave to each other on the lot. Obviously, that means something. No, it doesn't. And the Hollywood Reporter was Kim Masters, who broke the story, you know, specifically, you know, said her sources were telling her that this was not a move to move Kathleen Kennedy out. So, but I'm fine with that.
But there's a small section of fandom that doesn't like Kathleen Kennedy as the head of Lucasfilm. Get over it.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's because if she's a woman or just because they don't like the fact that Disney bought Lucasfilm and somebody else besides George Lucas is in charge, or I think it's probably a bit of all.
Or the new franchise.
Mm-hmm. With girls in the lead. Blah. Yeah.
Or Kylo Ren being a ripoff Darth Vader. He's not.
No.
And I had this fight.
I agree with you. I think 100%.
I find him a better character, actually, than Darth Vader ever was. And I think someone out there who's listening just put a fatwa out on me.
Let me ask you this, because literally this popped into my head just now. Do we get more depth out of Kylo Ren because he's not wearing a helmet, so Adam Driver is able to kind of act and emote and give us layers of the character through facial expression that we just don't get with big, giant, enclosed in armor Darth Vader?
No.
You don't think so?
I mean, that may be part of it, but I mean, his character himself, Darth Vader, up until the third film, particularly the third act of the third film,
mm-hmm.
he stays completely, almost completely level. He doesn't really fluctuate up and down and all around. He seems to have this path, and he's perfectly happy where he is until the third movie.
I would say definitely through the first movie, he is just a presence. He's not much more than that as a character. I would say there's some shading in Empire Strikes Back.
I've watched Empire dozens
recently?
Of times, and I probably about a year and a half ago.
Real? Okay.
And I did not see it there. I saw it in Return of the Jedi, but mm-hmm. I didn't see it in the first two.
I think in Empire, especially when he's having the confrontation with Luke, he's like, Luke, join me. You know, it's not so much of join me and we can be powerful and evil together. It's kind of like I felt there are lined readings in there where he is imploring him as, I want to be your father. Join me and we can rule, you know, the galaxy as father and son. But there seems like he was looking for a piece of him that was lost, and he just recognized it for a brief moment there. And it's all James Earl Jones's tone of voice, more so than David Prowse's miming and physical action, because,
yeah,
you know, no offense to David Prowse, you just can't do much in that costume in terms of subtlety.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why, you know, Adam Driver gets to have a lot more depth with Kylo Ren, because you can see it on his face. You can see conflict on his face and not just have to maybe hear it in his voice, which is also being, you know, going through a couple of filters and then mixed in with the gas mask
feel
sound
it.
And everything.
You can feel it in the first film and the majority of the first film. Guess what? He's got the damn mask on.
That's true.
You can hear it in his tone of voice through the mask. I just feel he is a better character. And mm-hmm. if anyone out there is wondering why, and my thoughts on him from Last Jedi into what I believe possibly may happen in Rise of Skywalker, which I am starting to doubt now, but it was good. It was a good theory at the time mm-hmm. after I saw Last Jedi. Go back and read the article that I did on Film Buff Online. What was that, about 2 years ago?
Just about 2 years ago, mm-hmm. right after Last Jedi came out.
Yeah. And I feel like I really tried, when I started to delve into the character of Kylo Ren after seeing Last mm-hmm. Jedi, that's when I started realizing he's a better fucking character. Like, I was up for days just analyzing and going through every scene in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Every scene in Force Awakens.
We went to see it a couple of times just so you could follow up on a few things.
Yeah, too. Yeah, it's true.
Including the time we drove home in that snowstorm.
I think I saw it, what, 4 or 5 times in the mm-hmm. cinema, and the same with Force Awakens.
Yeah.
Because I was just going over every little moment.
But let's kind of table our Kylo Ren discussion for December when we do the big
Adam Driver
episode, but the big Star Wars episode I'm thinking about we should do right before.
Wait, we're doing an Adam Driver episode? This is news to me.
We could do an Adam Driver episode. Adam
He's
Driver
had a big
appreciation.
Year.
My God, yeah. It's crazy. Yeah, but just moving on really quickly, kind of across the superhero aisle there from Marvel, I did want to mention some of the crazy casting announcements that have come out of the CW's big Crisis on Infinite Earths superhero TV show crossovers.
And this is when I step back from the mic and let him take over.
You zone right out. I know.
Yeah.
This little subset of nerddom is not for you. I know.
I've never watched any of the DC CW television shows. And at this point, there are so many of them and mm-hmm. so many seasons. One, I don't know where to start. And two, there's just too much. I haven't even finished the Netflix Marvel binge. Mm-hmm. So go away.
But yeah, so like in the last 2 weeks, they first kind of like made this amazingly shock announcement that Tom Welling from Smallville, which ran for 10 years on the old WB before that fell apart and became the CW, is coming back to play Clark Kent / Superman in Crisis on Infinite Earths. And then a day later, they announced that Erica Durance, who played Lois Lane on that show, is also joining him. So that's going to give Crisis on Infinite Earths, which is the banner title for this year's crossovers between Arrow, Flash, Supergirl, DC's Legends of Tomorrow, and the new Batwoman show. So we got those two coming back. We've got, that gives us a total of 3 Supermen all together. Tyler Hoechner, who plays Superman on Supergirl, is going to be there. And then Brandon Routh, who played Superman in Superman Returns from director Bryan Singer, is going to also be playing a version of Superman, as well as his character of Ray Palmer, a.k.a. the Atom, from DC's Legends of Tomorrow. So we've got 3 Superman men, 2 Lois Lanes, and they announced, you know, that the actor who plays the Western hero Jonah Hex on Legends of Tomorrow in a couple of episodes is going to be involved. They added Supernatural's Osric Chow to the cast for the crossover, playing yet another version of the Atom. And just also right at the end of this past week, they announced that Ashley Scott from Birds of Prey, the 2006 short-lived series that only ran...
Shamar Moore. That one I didn't know.
That one only ran 13 episodes. And they announced that her version of the Huntress is now going to be part of this. And I'm just like, okay, if we're pulling from Smallville and Birds of Prey, any live-action DC TV character or actor is probably fair game to show up in this thing. And that's kind of exciting to me because it makes this thing feel really epic. And I think it's probably going to be as epic as television can get, you know, in a trying to parallel something like Avengers Endgame, where you just have everybody showing up. You know, Howard the Duck gets a half a second cameo on screen. They're going completely balls out on this. And that's exciting to me that they're doing something this ambitious on, you know, a TV scale, and it still sounds like it's going to be pretty big. So that should be fun. And that's something I'm going to be looking forward to when it airs in December and January of this year. And also, just because Crisis on Infinite Earths is one of these seminal DC Comics storylines, and it was one of my favorites when I was reading it as it was happening when I was back in high school. But let's kind of veer away from what's coming up on TV that seems exciting, and we'll be right back with a few trailers in just a moment.
Mm-hmm. How you doing, Holly?
How's it going?
Howard.
Put Pesach out.
All right, Larry, you're a Jew again. Welcome back.
I made a crazy risk. You gambled. And it's about to pay off.
So I want the Celtics to cover. I want the Celtics halftime. I want Garnett points and rebounds.
What do you know?
I don't know. I just know.
Well, I'll tell you what I know. It's the dumbest fucking bet I ever heard of.
I disagree. I disagree, Gary.
What is that?
I started it.
Are you serious?
You're taking my money all over town, placing bets.
I'm having very serious second thoughts.
Are you serious right now?
I know I fucked up.
Howard, where's the money right now?
Howard, got my money?
Howard! Is it too late?
I'm done. That means nothing. It meant nothing. Please. Give me another shot. You like to win, right? This is no different than that.
Black Joe, power, nigga.
This is my fucking way.
You think I'm stupid, Howard? You and your whole fucking family. I heard you've resurfaced your fucking swimming pool. You know how that makes me feel.
Never resurfaced anything.
You think your life is more important than my life?
I don't know who said that.
I told you about how things were gonna go. You like the way things are going now?
That's my family.
Get the kids out of the house.
You having a good time?
Yes. This is me. This is how I win. KJ, it's game night. You should be stretching out.
What is he, a coach?
Nah, he's just a fucking crazy-ass Jew.
And that was just a few brief moments from the first trailer for Uncut Gems out of A24, starring Adam Sandler and Idina Menzel. Wow.
I have not wanted to see an Adam Sandler movie. the way I want to see this Adam Sandler movie.
I have never wanted to see an Adam Sandler movie. And I'm like, okay, I'm down.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so down for this. I am on the floor. I don't know what that meant, but okay. I think the sentiment was
yes,
understandable.
Yes. Yeah, it's from the Safdie brothers, so that's exciting. We also got Julia Fox in here, The Weeknd.
Lakeith Stanfield
mm-hmm.
from Sorry to Bother You.
Eric Bogosian.
Judd Hirsch.
Judd. Always love the Judd Hirsch.
Love the Judd Hirsch. and Pom Klementieff from Guardians of the Galaxy, Mantis.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Be nice to see her without crap ton of makeup on her.
Yeah, right. I find it so strange that the main two characters for this are Adam Sandler and Idina Menzel. I mean, you're talking a man who is known for high comedy, and I want to okay, maybe not high comedy, but
lowbrow comedy,
very
mostly,
lowbrow
honestly.
Comedy, and a woman who is known for musicals,
mm-hmm.
who is in Disney long before she was in Disney as Elsa. I mean, we're going back to Enchanted 2006 here, baby.
Yeah, I know.
Rarely ever does live film. The only things that I can really think of that she has done is Enchanted and Rent.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that there are things out there that I am missing, but this doesn't
sure
seem like her usual.
When they do the eventually do the film adaptation of Wicked, she'll be in that. 'Cause
I think it's getting a little too far for that.
Okay.
Because Wicked came out like early 2000s.
It was 2004, 5, 6, somewhere in there. I saw it.
I know she'll make
right after
she'll probably
it opened,
make an
actually.
Appearance, but she won't be reprising the role.
You don't think?
No.
Oh, that'd
absolutely
be a shame.
Not.
That'd be a shame because she was magnificent.
Oh, God, yeah.
That was a magnificent show.
Yeah.
It just really was. I was totally blown away when I saw that. And then the next night I saw Mark Hamill in something too and got to meet him. So it was a great weekend that weekend.
But then she's done things like Beaches, and she was on Glee. But we're talking all like musical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a freaking musical.
I know, which is exciting, actually. Is this going to be a new phase of her career?
I hope so.
Yeah.
Because I'd like to see what we're able to pull from these two actors in this. And The Weeknd, that was also another surprising casting choice.
I'm just taking a look here, and I don't see Idina Menzel having anything else on her filmography right now, except for Frozen 2, which we'll get to in just a moment.
I was getting there.
So
you didn't have to say it.
hopefully this is the start of something, you know, a new path on her career. We just haven't heard too many announcements about it yet.
Mm-hmm.
I keep hoping that, you know, maybe this will be something, a nice divergent path for Adam Sandler to go on, because I'm not a fan of his comedies. I think they're too broad and they're too stupid.
Thank you.
But he's amazing in Punch Drunk Love.
Yeah.
So and that was when I was like, oh boy, I really hope he, you know, kind of branches out and does a lot of, you know, some more dramas or mixes it up at least. And this is like the first thing that I've really been interested in. I know some of his films have had a little bit more of a dramatic bent here and there. But
A Click on occasion I find I can watch.
Mm-hmm.
But I prefer the second act to the first act when it takes that dramatic turn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so hopefully, you know, maybe this will be an outlier. Maybe this will be, you know, the next step on him being a more dramatic actor as well. Who knows? We'll see. But to get back to that Disney film.
Which one?
I believe that would be Frozen 2. It's hard to say which Disney film anymore because, you know, they release 40% of all the films now in the market.
Yeah, good point.
Something crazy like that. But yeah, we finally got a trailer for their big, for the sequel.
Oh, did we?
Yes.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Yes, we finally got a trailer to the sequel to their big hit Frozen. Creatively titled Frozen 2, and here it is.
Far away, as north as we can go, once stood an enchanted forest.
You've seen an enchanted forest?
Yes, it was a magical place, but something went wrong. Since then, no one can get in or out.
Wow, Papa, that was epic.
What would I do without you?
You'll always have me.
Has Elsa seemed weird to you?
She seems like Elsa.
There's this voice.
Voice? What does that mean?
Head for the cliffs!
I'm gonna blow!
I've got you!
The kingdom is not safe. Find who is calling to you. They may have answers.
I'm going with you.
Anna? No.
Excuse me, I climbed the North Mountain, survived a frozen heart, and saved you from my ex-boyfriend. So, you know, I'm coming.
That's normal.
Where are we?
How did you get in the forest?
The mist parted for us.
Impossible.
Where did you learn magic?
Follow me into fire.
Then don't run into fire.
Magic is very alluring. Without you, she may lose herself to it.
Protect Arendelle at all costs.
I believe in you, Elsa, more than anyone or anything.
Question. Is the whole putting us in mortal danger gonna be a regular thing?
And that was a few moments from the new trailer for Frozen 2, Disney's follow-up to their big hit from 2013. And it looks like it's going to be a fun adventure movie more so than a princess movie, or, and I kind of like that. I'm looking at you though, and you're kind of look nonplussed by the whole thing.
It looks beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't tell what the hell's going on. I can't piece together any sort of plot.
There's a mysterious area they go to and discover another kingdom, and lots of running around happens.
Wow.
I don't know. But okay. Maybe I just simplified that a bit too much.
Teaser trailer that was released, I think that was a couple months ago. Again, it was just a bunch of beautiful shots. No idea the plot.
Mm-hmm.
This one gives a little bit more, but I can't figure out who. It says, let go of the past. Okay. What? Frozen was about Elsa and what was inside Elsa that could potentially be dangerous to mm-hmm. everyone. Obviously, we can't reutilize the same theme. We have to piece together some sort of villain from the outside. But it seems like they're still hedging on her, that power inside her being too much for her to handle. There's something, I don't know. I'll probably go see it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I'll probably find time. In fact, I'm more interested in seeing this than I kind of was in seeing the first one, and I'm not sure why.
I saw the first Frozen film the week after it was released on DVD, and it was I saw it in the cinema. It was still in the cinema when it was released on DVD. Like, that's how long that movie was in for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is unusual these days, because I remember when Raiders of the Lost Ark came out. That came out in... opened in May,
mm-hmm.
and we went to see it, well, for me, my second or third time at this point, for my younger brother's birthday, which was November 30th.
Wow.
So, yeah, so that was in for a good solid 6 months.
Yeah.
And that was normal for a hit movie.
And it was the same with Frozen. It was in for freaking ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I got forced into go seeing it, and I actually thoroughly enjoyed it.
I enjoyed the first one, too, when I finally got around. I caught up with it once it hit home video as well.
Yeah.
Well, actually seeing it at home on home video as opposed to it being released on home video and you're still going to the theater to see it.
Yeah.
And I had fun with it. I was like, okay, it's not as... I don't know what I was kind of expecting, but it wasn't quite what I was expecting. It wasn't quite as cloying or cutesy or talking down to the audience because mm-hmm. they figure we're primarily focusing this at kids.
Yeah.
You know, so I really appreciated that.
And I appreciated the animation. The first shot was a damn, the blade cutting through the ice right at the audience. And I remember going, ooh. Like my head like jumped back a mile and a half because I thought that was coming right at me. And I'm like, okay, that was it. That was impressive for animation.
Okay.
And it wasn't in 3D, but it still had that effect.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, okay, I'm in for the long haul. Let's see what else other tricks you have up your sleeve here.
True. So I think we're marginally thumbs up on seeing this.
We're marginally thumbs up.
Okay. Okay.
Let me see.
We are marginal, and we're big thumbs up on Uncut Gems so far. Okay.
Now let's see if we are thumbs up or thumbs down. No pun intended for mm-hmm. our next film called Clemency.
How do you keep doing it?
I do my job.
These next 24 hours are crucial. Anthony's defense attorney has already asked for a reprieve from the governor's office.
You want to play as good guys and bad guys. And I'm one of the bad guys. These men respect all the way through.
I want to share a bed with my wife. How long is this going to be going on?
to be seen and to be heard. It is not over.
I don't know if this is going to make things better, but I'm trying.
You can't understand. You can't know what it's like. I am alone.
I am going to fight for him right up until the very moment you stick that needle in his arm.
You've given me hope. I can't do this on my own anymore.
I want to be home.
Warden.
And that was the trailer for the Sundance Buzz hit Clemency with Alfre Woodard. And that looks pretty intense, and I'm loving that.
Yeah. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. I don't think we've seen a kind of like a death row drama like that since...
It's been a while.
Dead Man Walking? Something like that?
It's been a while.
Mm-hmm. So that's exciting to me. Mm-hmm. Heck of a cast. You've got in there, obviously, Richard Schiff from The West Wing. So.
I love how you went straight for Richard Schiff. Of course you did.
Oh, what am I supposed to say? Richard Schiff from Man of Steel? No. It's Richard Schiff.
Oh, shit. He was in Man of Steel?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
He played Dr. Emil Hamilton.
I haven't watched Man of Steel in forever.
Hamilton was one of my favorite characters in the comics for a certain amount of time, and then
well, you're a DC fan, I'm a Marvel fan, so
I was like super stoked that Richard Schiff was playing him. Then they kill him off in the movie. I was like, you bastards. But you know, you've got Richard Schiff, you've got Wendell Pierce, which is exciting because you know, obviously he was in Selma, he's in Horrible Bosses, he was also in, oh, jeepers. What was that other thing I remember seeing him in, and I can't remember. It was like...
I see he's in The Wire, and he's mm-hmm. on Jack Ryan right now on Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's been around. He's done a lot of work, both in TV and film. So good for him.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's going to... It looks like he has a nice supporting role here.
Yes.
Like I said, looks pretty intense. Your thoughts?
You're missing someone.
Who? Who am I missing?
Alfre Woodard.
Oh, I said her right at the beginning.
Mm-mm.
Yes, I did.
No, you went straight for Richard Schiff.
No, I said starring Alfre Woodard.
Well,
right at the beginning.
You didn't even discuss her.
Well, okay. Well, let's circle back and just obviously hit the career highlights of Alfre Woodard here.
You better, because she deserves it.
No kidding.
Where do you want to start? Do you want to start Marvel, Disney, 12 Years a Slave?
let's kind of leave some of that other stuff aside. You know, we're not going to sit here and...
Scrooge.
I was going to say First Contact, Star Trek.
Oh. But... Or because we were talking about this earlier, K-Pax.
Oh, God, no. But even in something like a genre thing, like... Captain America, Civil War, or
she was Luke fantastic Cage. On Luke Cage.
Yeah, she was amazing on Luke Cage. She totally brings it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm all down for, you know, seeing whatever she's doing here as well.
Hell yeah, bring it, girl.
Oscar contender, possibly.
I'm gonna say no.
Really? Why?
I feel like it's not bringing the heat. For to be an Oscar contender, like the film that we are going to talk about in the main portion of our podcast this week, it doesn't have the star power. It's flying very low key under the radar. This is the first time I've heard of it. I have not heard any buzz coming out of any other film festivals or anything apart from Sundance.
I think that's probably, I don't think Neon has shown it at any other festivals.
Yeah.
I think they bought it at Sundance, or they bought it right before Sundance. I can't remember which, and I apologize. And then they kind of been like holding this card close to their chest on this one. It is coming out December 27th. So, you know, it is qualifying for an Academy Award run.
It has to qualify for a week, doesn't it?
In a week, LA, that's, a week and, that's in LA, a week that starts in the calendar year. So
a week that starts in the calendar year. Okay. So technically, we do have the possibility of an Oscar run for this film.
Mm-hmm.
Do I think it's going to get the traction it needs? Unfortunately, no.
Okay.
But I have been wrong before. Look at what happened with The Wife.
That's true. That's true.
That, you know,
didn't get much traction in a wide variety of categories, but definitely got Glenn Close. close to an Oscar.
Yeah. I think she lost it, didn't she?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember to who, because I'm blanking big time.
But let's jump from one buzzed about film that's coming out soon to a just released buzzed about film. And we'll be right back in a few moments with our review of Hustlers.
The financial crisis that started with the subprime mortgage crisis in 2007 and culminated in the September 2008 collapse of the investment bank Lehman Brothers, affected people around the world in a variety of ways. People saw their retirement savings vanish in a puff of smoke, and the value of their homes plummet nearly overnight. Numerous millionaires on paper, Wall Street investment bankers were suddenly broken out of work. And that had a direct effect on the people that they did direct business with in New York, be in household staff, restaurants, or even the dancers at Manhattan's high-end strip clubs. But according to New York Magazine writer Jessica Pressler's 2015 article, The Hustlers at Scores, some of the dancers at Manhattan's highest profile strip joint figured out a way to survive by fleecing some of the few remaining high rollers who would visit the club. The Robin Hood steal from the rich but maybe not give to the poor vibe of the story intrigued writer-director Lorene Scafaria, who optioned the story and wrote a screenplay that attracted the folks over at Will Ferrell and Adam McKay's production company, Gary Sanchez Productions. And after a number of directors passed on the project, including Martin Scorsese, who expressed interest but was busy prepping The Irishman, Scafaria was finally given the chance to direct the story herself. Recruiting Jennifer Lopez to play the ringleader of the band, Scafaria has delivered Hustlers into theaters following some initial strong word of mouth out of the Toronto Film Festival earlier this month. So, Rich.
Yes.
This story was based off of a magazine article.
Mm-hmm.
But does it keep with its journalistic vibe throughout the story in the film?
Ooh, that's a good question. And I would say yes.
Really?
Yes. Because I think the film does a really neat trick right about three quarters of the way through, actually.
Anything you want to discuss?
Well, yeah. Okay, there's going to be some mild spoilers here and there. The film starts off and you think we're just getting the story of these women.
Mm-hmm.
Dorothy slash, who dances under the name Destiny, played by Constance Wu. Ramona, who's played by Jennifer Lopez. They meet and they become friends and... Ramona takes Destiny under her wing, so to speak, and shows her around, shows her the ropes of working at a high-end club like Moves, a.k.a. Scores. And then it kind of flips and we jump forward several years and we see that Destiny slash Dorothy is telling this story to a reporter played by Julia Stiles. And suddenly all the voiceover and everything is Julia Stiles' character gathering this story from Dorothy. The film kind of just doesn't put too fine a point on it, but that's what's happening until late in the story when Julia Stiles asks a question. They cut back to the frame, what's now, you know, what you're thinking is now the framing device, and Julia Stiles asks a question And Constance Wu's character basically gets mad about that question, turns the recording device off, and the sound goes out on the film as Julia Stiles' character gets up, grabs her purse, and kind of walks out. And that, you know, the entire film is silent until she's outside and Constance Wu slams the door behind her. And then the sound kicks back in. And this is really the story, in a way, of the reporter character gathering this story from Constance Wu's character. And that's only like three quarters of the way through, somewhere in the, you know, some part of the third act where you suddenly realize that. And it's a great trick from Lorraine's Scafaria. And I was kind of very impressed with how that worked when we saw the film just the other day.
I remember you going, ooh.
Yes. So that's probably why you're asking me that. You were just setting me up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But what did you think of that? How did you react to that? I don't want to call it a reveal or a switch or anything, but the way it kind of unfolded in front of us like that.
No, I thought that was a very smart choice to have the whole story. And I discussed this with you briefly in the car yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
That there was, this is very much more of a journalism story than it is a stripper story. Yes, almost the entirety of the film takes place in 2007, 2008, and we're flashing back and forth between Constance having this interview to what happened in her past.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not Constance's story. She's very much the main character in the past because she's telling the story, but it is how Julia Stiles, as the reporter, is perceiving said story.
True.
In her own mind that frames how it's being told in the past. So in the way I imagine it, her article is already written. And as Constance is telling this to her, this is how everything that we see is how Julia sees it in her head
and how she wrote it.
Exactly.
Okay. I like that. That's an interesting. Now let me ask you this though,
mm-hmm.
because we really, outside of one instance, one short instance, don't get her interviewing or anybody else or hearing what anybody else said as she as Julia Stiles' character was gathering.
Are you going to ask me if she's biased?
No, I'm asking, is Constance Wu a reliable narrator?
Is anyone a reliable narrator when giving an interview about something like this?
That's true. But
there's always different sides to a story, and the truth is always somewhere in the middle.
Very true. But do you believe Constance Wu's character for the most part, or do you think she's maybe brushing her own self up a little bit to appear better
and cleaner? I believe that Julia believes her.
Okay. And I think that might be the more pertinent viewpoint to have than, you know, do we believe the character or not?
Because like I said, the truth, when you have an article and you're interviewing different people and all those different people don't seem to talk anymore, I have a feeling there are going to be changes to make themselves always look a little bit better.
Oh, yeah.
So whether that be Constance Wu's character of Destiny or Jennifer Lopez's character of Ramona or Lily Reinhardt's character of Annabelle, everyone's going to have different memories of the events.
Mm-hmm.
And if they weren't there for some of them, well, then they may just put themselves into it just to say, hey, this is what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's always a reporter's job is to mm-hmm. kind of
figure
out where the Venn diagrams overlap. And hopefully that's where the truth is.
Mm-hmm.
The truth does lie.
Yeah. And so the story, because I believe the story is told from how Julia perceives everything. Constance at one point is making Julia Stiles a cup of tea, and she's talking about the drug that they were using on the guys, which was ketamine mixed with MDMA. And she was mentioning, oh, we decided, you know, maybe to tweak the recipe. And when she gives her the cup of tea, the mug, Julia kind of quickly, and it's so quick that you could slightly miss it, but it's a nice comedy beat where she kind of looks at the coffee or looks at the cup of tea while they're talking about the drug mixture and then decides, okay, I actually am going to take a sip of this.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that she sort of does believe what her subject is telling her. And so I believe the reporter.
Okay.
I am probably going to say something that will also get another fatwa put out on me. I don't think there should be Oscar buzz for Jennifer Lopez. I think there should be for Constance Wu.
I would agree with you very much so. And
I was kind
of leaning over towards that to kind of push this conversation in that direction in terms of the performances. Jennifer Lopez gives a very fine performance.
Yeah, she's great.
But
she doesn't have as much to do.
No, she doesn't. And I know it should
actors.
Be best acting, not most acting. But I think Constance Wu is given more to do, so she's able to show a better range throughout this film.
Well, if Jennifer Lopez got a nom for anything, it should be in the supporting actress category.
Yeah.
And I would say that maybe she does deserve mm-hmm. a supporting actress
nom. Yeah, but this is definitely
nom.
Constance Wu's film.
Yeah. And that's the problem that I have with how this film is being marketed. It's a Jennifer Lopez movie. Mm-hmm. She's the headliner.
Well, the movie wouldn't have been made without Jennifer Lopez. You know, the director basically said if she didn't want to sign on to this picture, it wasn't getting made because I couldn't see anybody else playing this role. And quite frankly, anybody else in the role probably wouldn't have gotten the film financed.
Good point.
So,
and she's fantastic as Ramona. And mm-hmm. she does give one hell of a performance emotionally and physically.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of scenes where she is pole dancing, and that is entirely her on the pole.
You can tell it's entirely her on the pole.
In fact, I was listening to an interview.
I was watching her rehearsal footage. It's like 15 minutes long.
I was listening to an interview with Lorraine Scafaria. Jennifer Lopez was out there, like when she was out on tour, she took a pole with her and was practicing every free chance she could get for like a couple of months leading up to this. And she was working with a choreographer to develop the routine for the big number that you see her in when the character's introduced.
She was also working with pole dancing requires a certain amount of muscle strength, particularly in the back, shoulders.
And the core.
And that is something that you actually really have to train your body mm-hmm. to handle.
Oh, yeah. And they choreographed this whole thing, showed it to Scafaria and her DP about 2 weeks before they were scheduled to shoot it. And they're like, we got to shoot this like a stunt. We got to just put cameras everywhere on her for this. You know, because, they went through it about 5 or 6 takes, but, she didn't want to, do like 14 setups of the same thing over and over and make, Jennifer Lopez do the whole routine over and over and over again. Because even no matter how great a shape you're in, when you're just doing that all day,
it kills you after a while.
Yeah. So
you're in pain.
Mm-hmm. I give her a lot of credit for what she does in the film. I just don't think it is as much as Constance Wu was doing there. She's this film's secret weapon.
Oh, yeah. Big time. And I'd like to also talk about the people in the supporting roles that you see and you don't see.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Lily Reinhart. You spent most of this film upchucking.
Yeah. Is nervous vomiting like an actual thing? Like, you get the slightest bit nervous and bleh.
There are some people I know. I do know one person in particular where that is very much a thing.
Oh, God. Oh, that poor person.
I know. And it's hard to take them anywhere.
Fair enough.
There's that.
Mm-hmm.
That was a thing. Kiki Palmer, I thought she was a lot of fun as Mercedes.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of Mercedes, Mercedes Rule is in this as kind of like a character's name is Mother, and she's kind of like a backstage mom, stage manager for the strippers at first. Mm-hmm. And I mean, she's wonderful. Hers was one of those characters where you're just like, I just wanted a little bit more.
Yes.
Especially, in the one time jumped where they jumped from the heyday of the club in 2004, 2005, 2006. And then they jump to a couple years after the crash and when things aren't going so well. And I sort of wanted a little bit more of what happened with her over that time. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think that story is very pretty. But I think it would be interesting for her to at least have kind of let us know about it a little bit.
I was right.
What?
By the way.
Hmm.
Nana.
Oh, yes. Constance Wu's grandmother in the movie, played by Wai Ching Ho.
From Daredevil, Madame Gao. I was right. I'm
and
like
the Defenders.
I,
yes.
Yeah, I so. Was. I was sitting there yesterday in the car. I'm like, she looks so familiar. I think she was like in Daredevil or something
Yeah, I think I kind of
she was.
Said maybe. So yeah, you. Yes, you are right there.
Mm-hmm. I'm good. I loved Cardi B in this. She only has, I think, what, two, maybe three scenes.
Mm-hmm.
But she's just a fucking riot. I'm not a fan of her music, but I did have an appreciation for her comedy chops in this.
Yeah, I know. Hopefully we'll see some more of that from her.
Yeah. And Lizzo looked like she was having fun.
Oh, yeah.
She was only in for, I think, two scenes. And those two ladies were in the film for the first act.
Yes.
Not so much when everything goes downhill.
And when they all become criminals.
Yeah. They weren't there for the criminal part. Sorry, guys. But yeah, they looked like they were just having the time of their freaking lives.
Oh yeah, and that's what's great about this movie.
They are all having fun.
Yes.
You can tell.
There is a certain amount of fun to the film. It's not like and again, you know, when I had read that Scorsese was the first person they took this script to, I could sort of see the Martin Scorsese version of this story.
You and I both.
And it's not the film we saw. It's an entirely different movie. which would be really interesting, and it would probably be a really good Martin Scorsese film, but I'm kind of glad he didn't make this.
I don't think it would have the same feeling to it that it needed. Mm-hmm. Scorsese's great.
It would have been skeezier.
Let me get to this.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Scorsese is great at what he does. The Departed, Wolf of Wall Street, Gangs of New York, hell, even Goodfellas. He's really good with crime dramas.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all male. And there is a certain attitude. And you and I have discussed this before in other things. That there is a different attitude between a male-run film and a female-run film. There's different motivations. There's different ways that you handle situations. One of the things that just kind of brings that to mind is Goodfellas, when they're sitting around the table at the restaurant and Joe Pesci's getting annoyed with Ray Liotta, and Ray Liotta is kind of freaking out because he thinks he offended his friend, and then it just turns out to be all one big joke, and then... You can't have that with a female-run film. There's a certain attitude and macho-ness that Scorsese brings to his films that kind of can't be over here.
No.
So I like the idea that it was written by a woman, directed by a woman. Almost the majority of this is a female-led cast.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it is a female-led cast.
There's... barely any male characters in this.
There's only one male actor that I recognized. And no, I mean apart from Usher. There's there's one male actor that I recognized. Other than that, I didn't know anyone. And I like that about this movie. It keeps it very much in a certain frame of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what makes this film so goddamn empowering.
And impactful, too.
Yeah.
I mean...
they don't treat the film in any way with its subject matter as stripping is degrading. It's sexualized.
The sex work is not degraded, yes.
No. There's only one scene in which it ever feels degrading, and it is a moment where the women are not in control.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. Even in scenes where, like, there's a gentleman sitting with Lily Reinhart's character at a table. He's whispering in her ear, you know, let's go fuck in the bathroom. And it's not degrading because she, even though she's uncomfortable, she's very much the one in control of that scene saying, no, we're going to wait. My sisters are going to be here in a moment. And then the moment the girls walk in, he's just like, oh, yeah. And you're
he thinks he's in control.
He thinks and he's in control.
No.
But you know, in that situation, who's running the show. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's one scene in particular where it feels degrading, and it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
It has, they know exactly how to play that scene. So you do sit in the theater and you feel disgusted at it. And then in the next scene, automatically, it makes you want to get back at that guy,
mm-hmm.
And take the power back.
And that's the trigger moment for
Constance
what
Wu.
Happens. Yeah.
Yeah.
Going forward. Yeah, it's very much a female gaze movie, not a male gaze movie. I mean, none of the main characters, although they're all strippers, and there's no nudity there except for like a couple of extras in the background.
Yeah, there was no nudity on any of the main characters, mm-hmm. and that was impressive to me.
Obviously, you're not going to get Jennifer Lopez to sign up for a movie where she's going to whip her boobs out. But I'm sure at some point it must have been a bit of a sell, you know, explaining to her, okay, you're going to play a stripper. However, this is how we're going to approach it.
I think it was important to approach it like that.
Oh, yeah.
You kind of have to. Because you're talking scores, it is a strip club, but it is also very much a high-end strip club. That was the creme de la creme. And in this film, their version of it, Moves, has to have that same classiness to it. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have Wall Street people walking into a club where the bathroom looks like the worst bathroom in Scotland.
I was going to, if you weren't going to make the train spotting reference, I was.
Wow, leave me hanging over here on a high five.
Oh, sorry.
I mean, unless that's what they're down for, but I doubt they're going to do that because there's a certain cleanliness. There's a certain, they like the idea of spending the money that makes them feel like they're rich, like they have it to blow.
Mm-hmm.
And these women recognize that. So there is a certain atmosphere that they have to, it's like picking up a hooker off the street wearing fishnets and her makeup is like 5 days old versus calling for a high class escort. There's different levels.
Yeah.
And so not having a lot of nudity in this kind of generates that vibe in the club itself. And I found that really impressive that they decided to approach it maybe in that way.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. And yeah, there are times when nudity is needed in a film and times when it's just there to titillate or be exploitative. And this was one of those stories about women being in charge. So
anytime I saw nudity, it was very much the girl was just, it wasn't there for titillation. The girl just didn't give a fuck.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was, like you said, very impressive.
Mm-hmm.
I do kind of want to address something I've been kind of turning over my mind the last 30 some hours since we watched this. Dorothy does express regret for what she did at the end. Do you think the movie was condoning what the women did or not, though? Because I feel at times it was kind of, it's not a revenge movie. It's not about revenge. It's about, I mean, yeah, they say, you know, hey, these rich guys stole all this money, so we're just going to steal it, you know, from everybody, so we're just going to steal it back. But it's not like a Robin, like I said in the intro, it's not a Robin Hood revenge thing because they don't give it to the poor. They just keep rob it from the rich and keep it. So does the movie kind of condone or condemn these actions? I'm not quite sure how
that. Bit of both.
Does look like fun. Whee!
Well,
crime is fun.
Well, it wasn't crime is fun.
I know.
When they first looked at it, it was survival.
Mm-hmm.
And then survival just kind of gets out of hand after a while. When you have that kind of money and that kind of power, you get mm-hmm. hungry for more. So they actually start to become the thing that they are taking from.
They become their own
worst enemy.
Yeah.
And I like that Constance Wu's character is, she's one of the few people there who sort of remembers what it was like And so when they get a little too rambunctious, a little too ambitious, and to start taking more and more and more, and these guys can't pay anymore. They can't, you know, take care of their families.
They don't have any money to fleece.
Yeah. She remembers what it was like, and she feels bad. She's, at least the way our story tells it, she's the conscience of the group, which could be a story choice, or it could be a real life choice. I don't know. I didn't do my research on this article going into the film. I really wanted to keep it.
There's a great article in Slate this past week, kind of talking about the film versus the original article and the story choices that were made for the movie. And I'll try to remember to put that in the show notes post for this episode. If not, you can pretty much find it by, you know, a Google search, because that's how I stumbled across it. And I would recommend giving that a read.
Will do. I'll definitely go ahead and try to check that out. After seeing the film, it has made me want to do a little more research into this. I was familiar with scores. I didn't know about the hustle that was going on, but I was very much familiar with the club itself several years ago. So when I heard, oh, Hustlers at Scores, I'm like, wait, what?
Well, hey, I'm a longtime old school Howard Stern fan, so I, of course, knew about Scores in like the mid-90s, I think, is when I first heard of the place. So
I heard about them maybe about 6 years ago, something like that, 6-7 years ago. I definitely want to do some more research into this. I'll be definitely looking out for this film as award season ramps up. Looking forward to see if it starts landing awards along the way at the SAG and the BAFTAs, the Golden Globes, so on and so forth, all the way up to the Oscars, baby.
Yeah, this is one, you know, definitely a contender in several categories.
Yes, it is. And I have an idea of which ones, but I'm going to keep them to myself for right now.
Fair enough. But I think that about wraps us up for this week.
Remember, you can find us online at bigpicturepod.com. And we are now available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So either use the link in the show notes post or head directly there, search and hit subscribe.
And if you like what you're hearing, leave a positive review, because that always helps us connect with new listeners. Now, in just a few days, we're heading out to New York Comic Con.
Woo woo! Outlander panel!
So we'll be back next week with our report on that big event with maybe a couple of special guests.
Ooh! And that's all right here on the Big Picture Podcast.
Care.